fourth in a series on women's reality. And it's today we're going to be talking about managing the women's way, or the woman's way. I should say that I have been a manager for 6 years within a university setting. It's at Northwestern University, and I'm manager of a thing called the Center for Urban Affairs and Policy Research, which is a big social science research center within the university. And a lot of what I'm going to say obviously will come from that experience. I'll pass that around. Despite what Jody said this morning, I've never studied management. And I'm going to have that opportunity this summer. I'm going from here to a week of quote leadership training at Columbia University, and then for a month at Harvard to a program they have for people who think they might be interested in higher education administration. So you might be able to tell from that I'm considering leaving the teaching and research part of what I'm doing now and going into full-time administration. And so I haven't studied it yet, but I'm going to. So I hope I'll still have something to say that might interest you. Because everything I've done so far, I've done from sort of an intuitive sense, and frankly also in reaction to administrative styles that I didn't like, that I saw around the university. During the first part of this hour, I want to set some parameters that I think affect management style. But first, I'd like to know how many of you work in some kind of an organization or situation where you're working for someone else? Oh, not all that many. Do any of you have a boss who's a woman? Four. Do you, are there any of you who are self-employed, so you're the boss? One. Okay.
You have to say also that the IRS considers pastors self-employed, but I've never been able to feel self-employed. it's a strange kind of you do work for, and yet you really are looked at as...
You're part of an organization.
Yeah, right.
But on your own.
Yeah, it's a strange phenomenon. Sometimes way out
there
alone, other
times. Okay, now, I want you to, you can see I put a whole lot of adjectives up on the board. Were you going to say something?
Are you asking if anyone is a manager?
No, that's a good idea. Is anyone a manager? Good. Oh, I'm sorry. Are there anything else I left out?
I'm a homemaker.
Okay, good. That's one of the things I'm going to get to later, because I think homemaking is very good preparation for administration.
Do they work for themselves, or do they work for someone else?
We'll let them answer that. These adjectives on the board, I don't know if you can all see them all. All these adjectives were about good managers, were all in two different articles I read about management. And many of them have been associated with what people now talk about as a new administrative style, with new meaning that as opposed to the old administrative style, the new management styles include a lot of what in the past anyway have been called feminine styles of management. And I want you to, if I had thought of this in time, I would have brought Xerox sheets for each of you to mark on the side which of these adjectives you'd consider feminine and which you would consider masculine. Why don't we go ahead and try to go through some of these, but you have to choose. You can't say, well, it's both. Or it doesn't matter. These you have to choose. Soft. You think of that as feminine or masculine?
Feminine.
Logical.
Masculine.
Feminine.
Masculine.
Okay. Decisive.
Feminine.
You think it's feminine? Who said that? Most people would have put that with masculine. Facilitative.
Feminine.
Intelligent.
You can't ask us to answer out of our own reality. Outside of our own reality, we have to
see. Well, it's a sign the room is filled primarily with women. Okay, if you just go, you get the idea. If you go through all of these different words, you can get the idea that they really are, most of them in the past anyway, have been associated with either masculine or feminine styles. And I'm not sure which of these I am, but as we talk a little bit more, maybe you'll come to some conclusions about that yourself. But I think that it's certainly true that in management seminars and so forth these days, they certainly are talking about combining both the feminine and masculine style for greater success of the organization.
Now, can I ask you which ones, if we're not sure of where the typical thing would be, which ones fall into where? Like, I don't know about manipulative. Which would that be in the general population?
This is usually feminine, masculine, feminine, masculine, masculine, feminine, masculine, mm-hmm. masculine, masculine, feminine, masculine, feminine, masculine.
Where did you say these words came from?
They're in articles about management styles, leadership styles.
And you said they were good? When you were first explaining, you said these words that were described were good?
Well, in these, they've been associated with various leadership styles that have been successful in different places at different times.
So you're saying successful. Not good.
Yeah.
Successful.
Yeah. Okay, that was not clear. Yeah.
Again, that depends
because
on the type.
I was thinking successful. How do you get sinful, stupid, passionate?
Some of those might not go so well.
No.
Okay, masculine, feminine, feminine, feminine. Feminine, 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 feminine. This one was more masculine. Guilty, feminine, incompetent, feminine, gentle, feminine, severe, believe it or not, was feminine for some type of women. Castrating, of course, feminine. Tough, male. Oppressive, male. Talkative, female. Sympathetic, female. Killer instinct, male. Synthetic, female. Forthright, male. Assertive, male. Honest, male. Humorous, male. Angry, female. On time, male. In charge, male. Intimate, female. Friendly, female. Open, female. Moral, female. Manipulative, female. Committed, male. Leader, male. Intuitive, female. Sensitive, female. Responsible, male. Dependable, male. Meticulous, female. Thorough, female, and exploitative, male. So that we can all, I'm sure, think of both males and females who are representative of each side of those. Now, which set of these do you think would add up to the most effective management style at this point?
Definitely not female.
Now that those are the obviously these are sort of stereotypes.
Traditional stereotypes.
Traditional stereotypes, yeah. But as women got into management, many of these things, these feeling type things, the caring, the feeling, the being sensitive, the being talkative, a lot of those things began to creep in. And some women were very successful using those styles. And so that now the successful parts of that have been adapted into another set of, I mean, they've been merging into another style that has been being reported. Now, we'll leave these for a minute, and then we'll come back to them a little bit later. Right now, I want to talk about parameters that I think affect what kind of style a person can adopt. First of all, whether the organization or place that you work is profit or not for profit, or public or private. I mean, I'm not sure how this affects what you do, but I think it does. But we can talk about specific examples that where that may or may not make a difference. Whether or not the output of the organization is supposed to be creative, or whether it's supposed to be some kind of product that is something that everybody contributes to, but not, it isn't part of a creative process. Whether the organization is hierarchically organized is more consensual and participatory. Whether or not you yourself would, or the manager, him or herself, views the job as an administrator, as a manager, or as a leader. Now, one way of thinking about an administrator is that the real definition of that is much more like an executor, where you're carrying out the will or the wishes of somebody else. A manager is more likely to be a controller. I mean, this is, again, traditional sort of definitions. And a leader is more likely to be a facilitator. Now, another way to look at some of this is through what one author talks of, calls frames, a way to analyze organizations to try to find that, figure out which is the best type of style for which type of organization. And these frames, there are essentially four ways to view or analyze organizations, and any one of these frames might be dominant at any particular time or for a long time. The first one they call the structural frame, and that one emphasizes the importance of formal roles and relationships, and the structure of the organization is very clear on a chart, and they're created to fit an organization's environment and technology. Organizations allocate responsibilities to participants. They have a real division of labor, and they have rules and policies and hierarchies to coordinate a whole lot of different activities. And problems arise when the structure that they've set up doesn't really fit the organization, or the situation, I mean. And at this point, and when there are problems like that, then there's a need to reorganize as a remedy. The second frame, they refer to it as the human resource frame, and that's important because organizations are all inhabited by people, and those people all have needs, feelings, and prejudices. They have skills and limitations. They have great capacity. This view of things is that these people all have both great capacities to learn and great capacities to defend and protect old ways of doing things. And they have lots of times they're invested in the old ways in such a way that they don't appreciate attempts to bring about any kind of change. And here the key to effectiveness is the ability to tailor the organization to the people there and to find a form that enables people to get the job done and feel good about it at the same time. The political frame, which is the third one, views organizations as arenas of scarce resources where power and influence are constantly affecting both the allocation of resources among individuals and groups, and also the rewards. Conflict is expected because differences in needs, perspectives, and lifestyles among the people. There's a lot of bargaining, sense of coercion, compromise, and these are sort of everyday activities. They're not something that just comes up in some kind of crisis. Coalitions form around interests because power is unevenly distributed or else so broadly dispersed that no one can get anything done. And solutions are all developed through political skill, and much as in some, you know, Machiavellian kind of way, there's always the sense there's some conspiracy going on. And then the last frame, the symbolic frame, views organizations as held together more by shared values and culture than by goals or policies. And they're kind of propelled by rituals and ceremonies rather than rules and policies. And in this case, problems arise when people don't do what they're supposed to do, or they don't want to perform some ritual that's been part of the organization for a long time. Now, these authors say that each of these frames is present in all organizations, but one of the frames will be more dominant at any given time. And they suggest that that's an interesting set of ways to analyze whatever organization you're in, and particularly a good way to look at problems to figure out how to make changes. Now, now I'd like to share with you some of what I've learned and observed being an untrained administrator or leader or whatever I am at the Center for Urban Affairs. And also some of what's been observed about me and the way I do my job. And I have to say, I'm honestly not certain if my style is just my style or if it is obviously female. I do know that it's different from the two men that preceded me in the job. I'm the third director of this center. I want to say that I work in a nonprofit private setting, which is relatively non-hierarchically organized and has as its primary product a creative output. That is, I'm in a situation where I work with a lot of professors and a lot of support staff whose job it is to help those professors get their work done. Our organization itself is relatively non-hierarchical. We have a large executive committee that is supposed to be advisory to me, but we're within a very hierarchical setting. I report to the vice president for research, and he reports to the provost, and he reports to the president. And it's in no sense do I feel that I have that I'm able to participate in the decisions they make about us. I mean, it's clearly I report to them. And I think that feeling is not true about the setting where I am. It's been very important to me to be in a setting where I can try to live out what I think my faith teaches me about how I ought to be spending my time. The center, by and large, not everybody, but by and large, there is a focus on social justice issues. It was founded in 1968 in the wake of the urban riots all over the country, and the initial focus was on race relations. How in the world can we do something about race relations? Now, 17 years later, there's a lot of different foci, and you can see that from the little brochure that's going around, but it's not a definitely, it is a place where there's a feeling of commitment to a set of values. Now, I can't say that those are shared by absolutely everyone. We serve Nicaraguan coffee in the kitchen. We have a sign up that says that our place is a nuclear-free weapon zone, and that kind of thing. But there is also in the work that people do and in the questions that they think are important to look at, there is a sense of commitment to doing research on issues that have to do with social justice. I have to say that one of the first things I did when I became director was to buy new furniture for the office, and get the walls painted. And then I was absolutely astounded to find out that almost every woman does that when they get into a new position of some kind of authority, and I was a little embarrassed when I found out that most women do that. But the my reasoning for it was there was a huge, big, black desk that had all these secretive-looking drawers, and then there was a conference table with all this big, black, heavy furniture. And the boss that immediately preceded me had this reputation of being manipulative and secretive and so forth, that I didn't want to have, you know, somehow I wanted to get rid of that stuff, and I ended up buying a big table for my desk that has no drawers at all. So everything I'm working on is always on top. And so there's no, to me, it represents not keeping things secret. Now, I have no idea if other people view that, but I mean, that was something that was important to me. I've learned that to maximize creative output, it's important to create a culture or an environment of supportive politics, and as opposed to confrontation politics. And because it seems to me that confrontation politics very much saps creative energy. But then the other side of it is there's not always going to be some people who take advantage. And the trick is to try not to have, for me, is to try not to have a lot of oppressive rules. Like we have one person who honestly spent $125 on lunch. But it's only one person who tried that. And so to make rules that you can, that nobody can spend more than $10 for lunch out of their grants or whatever, I mean, the idea of spending $125 out of a federal grant for lunch, I mean, I thought was outrageous. So, and I was going to send out a blanket rule. Nobody can spend more than, if you spend more, you pay the difference type of thing. And a colleague suggested to me that I go to the one real offender and talk to him about it, and I did. But there's, in any case, I think it's very important to nip in the bud as quickly as possible any kind of tension between the faculty, between or among the faculty, or faculty and staff, or among the staff, because if people are angry and they feel tense around other people, they cannot do creative work. And in our case, the big important type of creative work people have to get out is articles and books for publication, and they cannot do it if there's a lot of tension around. I think it's important, the other thing is that this means that I see myself as a facilitator. I mean, I'm constantly seeing my role as one where I'm putting people together with resources, or telling people about somebody else who's interested in their work, or finding grant money for somebody who wants to work on a particular topic. I think it's very important to match people's skills and energies to the tasks that there are to do, and we're constantly reorganizing as we get new staff and getting, because new staff will bring different skills, and it gives you a chance to reorganize what things people are doing, and I think, and they seem to think, that it gives them a chance to be doing something different. It changes their jobs. They don't feel like they're doing the same thing all the time, and they seem to think that that's good. Now, faculty do that more or less by themselves as their research interests change. And that, in this case, I was talking primarily about support staff. I guess this means I'm very people-oriented, and that I think doing a good job of matching means knowing what's going on with people. And by this, I mean what's going on with them personally as well as professionally, their problems and concerns as well as their changing interests. So I talk to them, but when I'm in the office, my door is open. I've learned that I can't, that people will drop in, and when I want to be left alone, I stay home to work. I don't come into the office, because when I'm in the office, I expect people to be able to drop in, and I want them to do that. And I really am interested in what's happening with them, and that I think is partly because I'm a woman. Now, I don't know. Again, I'm not sure which of these things are me and which of these things are feminine.
I have to say that it's probably because you're a Christian.
Because I'm a Christian?
Mm-hmm. That you're interested in your college and in the people that you work with. I mean,
I never thought of that. I thought it was because my mother was a social worker. But it's she was the type who And she'd sit down on a bus, and 3 minutes later, someone was telling her their life story, and she just...
But Margo, that happens to you, too.
Oh, it does. But I think I learned it from my mother. But it's just, by osmosis. I don't know. But in any case, and I also think that it makes people more comfortable to tell you their problems or their concerns if you share a little bit of yourself. So I don't have any trouble doing that. But I do get criticized for this by other people who think that it makes me seem less of an authority and that they think I should protect my time a little more.
By those people on staff or by other managers? Like, who are you saying that?
By colleagues who observe this. They'll say to me, you don't need to learn about everybody. And I just disagree. And it doesn't, and I don't want to be seen as an authority, so I don't mind if it seems as less, if I seem as less an authority, because I don't want to be an authority. But on the other hand, I have one particular woman on the staff who really would, she wants to work for a person who is an authority. And it's very hard for her that I refuse to do this with her.
Why are you crying, little girl?
Well, this woman, I think I understand why she is that way, and I can talk to her about this, and I have, and I said, I'll just say to her, Audrey, I'm not going to do it that way. You know, if you want me to tell you what to do, that means that you really need a different working situation, because I'm not going to do it. And or I'm not going to give you orders. So, but that is an issue. I don't think I'm more compassionate than men would be, but I think I do find it much easier to show it to people, both in, you know, just being responsive and sensitive to them, but also I take that into account in making decisions. I believe that the best decisions are made when they are participatory and consensual, and when everyone in on the process has all the available facts. And because I reason that this makes that the decisions stick if everybody's involved in them. You don't have to redo them the next week. And it also means that if I tell them everything I know at the time, all the facts I have at hand to make the decision, that I'm trusted. I mean, what happens in this situation generally is that I lay out everything, and then we discuss it, and then they want me to make the decision anyway, because they trust me to do it, given that they know what the facts are. Now, this is another instance where I get very, very much criticized by one particular colleague who thinks that people, well, he doesn't think it anymore. When I first became director of the center, he thought that I was told far too much, and that I should keep the cards closer to my chest, he said. Don't put all the cards out on the table. So, and I said, well, if I don't put all the cards out on the table, how can people decide if they don't know some important fact because I haven't told them? And he said, yeah, but you want to keep the power yourself. And I have always thought that you get more power by sharing, or at least it isn't power if you're somehow holding back. I mean, there's some strange thing about that. Mm-hmm.
Don't you feel that's a female orientation? I mean, it's more, you know, the male orientation toward authority is to get it and keep it, mm-hmm. and women is more that.
Well, I now think that. I didn't know what to think before, but he thought that it was a female thing, and then because after 6 years, now he thinks that this is really a better way. Although he still, I mean, it hurts him to say that. I mean, he this is John, you know John. I mean, he really thinks that it's not a smart thing to do, but it's worked out. So he therefore will go along with it.
What it is you're talking about a situation dependency. If not everybody has the information, they're all dependent on you for the bits and pieces of it to make decisions. And you don't see that or don't talk about that perhaps, but that's the kind of relationship that's established. You're talking more about interdependence among the participants.
Well, see, the other thing is I see this center pretty much as a volunteer organization. People are half-time in their respective departments and half-time at our center where they are released from some of their teaching to do research. And they, if it's not a good place to be, they don't have to be there. And most of them want to be there because it is a good place to be. And because they get goodies. They get time off to do research, which a lot of university professors want. But it's also, it is, there have been times when people didn't want to be there. Not recently, but in the 7 or 8 years ago. And I think sharing this decision making makes them much more committed and builds a real sense of community that is important to keep the place going. And it's important to keep it as a place where you want to be.
Mm-hmm. You might be interested in this. About a year ago, I attended a seminar put on by Dun & Bradstreet. And what this was a seminar that helped you understand your own management styles. And at one part in the seminar, we have a look at how you make a decision. And I can't remember the four frames. I remember the one that I fell into, but the first one was a very autocratic type. The second one, the generic term for it was you were a driver. You know, you just wanted to get the work done. The third was someone that really acted on gut feelings and emotions, you know, just. And then the fourth, I think, was a real weak category. I can't remember. But I fell into the one of being a driver. And the symptoms are the kinds of things that I do are exactly what you're describing.
Well, maybe I just don't know. I mean, I'd have to see, more. I think another thing that has been said, I'm not exactly sure whether or not this is true, is that I am good at getting people, lots of other people to help. I don't make it appear that I'm doing all this. And I really don't think I am, but I mean, I really do feel that for that place to work, there has to be everybody involved in it. Another thing that, which I think may be a female characteristic, is that I don't have trouble praising people or saying to them, we need you to stay here. Your work is very good. And for some reason, this does seem to be hard for other people to do. And one time when it becomes very important at the university is when faculty members are being recruited from other universities. I mean, we have two or three people right now that Harvard is trying to hire, and that's very big competition for Northwestern, to put it mildly. And it's real important to be able to tell someone how valuable they are and that their skills are needed here and work with other people to get special salary increases and that kind of thing. But apparently, a lot of people find it hard to say those things to people, even when they don't want them to leave, even when they feel them. One thing that's a real problem for me is that while I believe that maintaining all the relationships is my work as director of the center, so everything goes smoothly, it's very hard for me to not think that my real work isn't my research. I mean, I've come home having worked all day long at these kinds of things and say to Andy, I didn't get any work done today. And what I mean by that was I didn't work on my research. Because somehow that's what counts in a university. And it's what, especially a research-oriented university like Northwestern. And it is a problem for me, and I keep thinking I have to change my thinking about that. I have another problem, which I think is also female, and that is it is important to me to be liked. And it's too important to me given the situation I'm in, because I can't, somehow that can't be important, and yet it is, and I don't know quite how to get rid of it. Now, I don't know if all this adds up to the meaning that I'm managing in a woman's way, but I do think that a lot of the characteristics I'm talking about are feminine, what we would normally think of them as feminine. I also think it sounds like it would fit in this driving type category as well. But one of the what I think is important is developing a style that's that is appropriate to whatever organization you're in and the people that are there, and that's also compatible with your own values. I'm not at all sure. In fact, I don't think I would have the same style in a different type of organization where there was a different kind of output. Yet I would still have to develop a style that was compatible with my values, or I would have stomach aches and headaches and everything very quickly.
I think the research also shows that no one stays in one style of management all the time, but you move according to many factors, but mostly the problem at hand. You know, there may be a time when you just absolutely have to make a decision like that. You cannot wait for all of that.
And for
whatever. Also, by how long you've been in the job, those pressures are on you. You know, just a multitude of things. But I think the whole idea was that you move in and out of these from time to time, day to day, from year to year.
Well, I think that that must be true.
How do you deal with, there was an interesting kind of Freudian slip there, compatible and combatible, that you said. You started saying combat and you changed it to compatible. And I find...
Did I really?
Yeah. I find in my life, I'm very similar to what you've been saying about yourself, except for giving praise. That's one place where I'm not there. So that's more male than in my book. But when there's somebody that's just not doing their work, and you really gotta, you know, somehow motivate them or move them elsewhere or fire or do all those sorts of things, but it gets to be more compatible, because I like to be nice and stuff like that. How do you find yourself managing in those positions, those ugly moments?
Well, I have a situation like that right now where my secretary is 65 years old, and she thinks she's becoming senile, and I'm coming to believe that she is too. and she just cannot cope with the word processors and so forth. She's very good at taking dictation and doing all kinds of other typing. Other types of secretarial thing, but there's a lot of things that she just can't do anymore. And one of since it's an interdisciplinary center, one of the big problems we have is organizing meetings with people from lots of different departments. And she, several times lately, has made appointments, two or three appointments for me at the same time. And then there'll be two or three people left standing, because I don't know that she's done this. Or she'll call people to organize a meeting, ask them what times they're available, and then never call them back to tell them when the meeting was set. And this kind of thing, she gets me to the airport at the wrong time. I missed two planes recently. And there's just, I talked to her about it. I know what her personal situation is, which is perfectly awful. She has she's no longer accruing vacation because she's got so much stored up she doesn't take it. So in this particular instance, what we're doing is reorganizing everybody's work. So she's going to take dictation for four or five different people, not just me. And these other things are going to be given to somebody else. I mean, and everybody understands, I don't want to give her a bad evaluation. She's only got two more years to go. She doesn't want to retire because she's got such an awful home situation. I don't want to have her fired. She's given wonderful service to the university for 30 years. You know, so you just have to figure out ways to move it around. You know, because I think it would be very inhumane to do some of these, and un-Christian, whoever used the word Christian, to just sort of say, well, she's dispensable since she's not doing, living up to the expectations. The other thing, a couple other things I wanted to say is that I think that any style works out, any style that proves to be successful is probably okay with the people at the very top of the organization. I mean, I think that if my way of doing things had meant that the center had somehow wasn't as productive as it used to be, or didn't get grants, or didn't do the things that we're supposed to do, that then they might say, wait a minute, whatever you're doing is wrong. But that hasn't been true. So somehow no one has really questioned me about this. I've also found that there are very few mentors out there for women, that is, other women who can be giving advice on things. But I also found that lots of the men in the administration are perfectly willing to share their sort of administrative secrets with me, because I'll ask them and I'll say, I have a problem with this. And so then they're willing to share. But apparently a lot of men don't tell other men they're having problems. They figure that they sort of have to tough it out. And yeah.
Do you tell other women that you're having problems?
Yes, but at our university there are no other women administrators until this past year, where the new president came in from the University of Colorado and brought a woman vice president with him, and it's the first time that Northwestern's had a woman vice president, and she and I immediately became friends, because I mean, she's the only woman in all kinds of situations, as am I, and we both found that we needed somebody else to talk to. So, I mean, it's, so there, I would. Now, I'm also a member of a group of women executives from the whole city of Chicago, and that group shares all kinds of things with one another. And lots of people there are real rivals with one another in competitive business situations, and they still share all kinds of problems and so forth. So I think it's just that at our particular, this is not true of other universities, but of our university, it's a very heavily male-dominated place. There just aren't other women in administrative positions. There are women, lots of women in faculty positions.
Mm-hmm. I think one very important word that needs to be up there is ego. And I have found that working with,
you're right,
really important word. And you know, I don't want to stereotype here, but I have found in working with I might get in trouble by saying this, male church leaders, and me being a young female church leader, has been very difficult for many of them. I see a lot of fear.
You threaten them.
A lot of pride. And you kind of mentioned this when you were talking. You know, I kept thinking pride, and I kept thinking ego and fear. And I see in you a real willingness. And, you know, I agree with what you're saying, you know, real openness. You know, what is there to hide? You know, real sharing of yourself. And in working and dealing with some of these male church leaders that really frustrate me, I see them as, I don't know what they're hanging on to or protecting, but...
their positions.
Yeah, you know, what is there to hang on to? I feel if you're a leader, you need to be able to, involve others and make them feel good, build up and courage, instead of hanging on to that power and being afraid to let it go and kind of, share.
Well, Susan, have you had that same experience? You must have.
The
same
kind
of thing
leader.
She's talking about, being,
yeah, I was
people
just,
being threatened. And
I'm just trying to think what it was, trying to find something like that. And I was thinking back to what I said last week and talking about throughout history, one of the reasons against women being leaders in the church, that is, ordained pastors especially, where you really run a situation of threat, was that this was a couple hundred years ago that was said that women could not represent the power and the sovereignty of God because they are too submissive and too subjective. I mean, they don't carry with them that kind of authority and aura of that we associate with God. And it fits in very neatly to the whole historical process of subjugating women and making them submissive. And, you know, it is that kind of a circle. You keep women down and say, well, you can't represent God because you're too downtrodden. You know, and say, wait a minute. And we don't question where that comes from. We say, oh, I am like this, therefore I can't do that. And there's something about religion that always has been this mystique. We talk about the mysteries of God and being caretakers of the mysteries of God. And it can be a very possessive thing, and then it can also be a very, you know, the word empowering isn't up there. That was one thing I've seen with women especially, that kind of, you become stronger as you share with others, you know, if you share the power, that sense of power of being limited is a very male concept. You know, if I give a piece of my power away, I am less powerful. And it's operating under a fear of loss, which influences our politics, our foreign policy, our economics, everything, that fear of losing what I have and having less. Whereas I think women have had that sense that, you know, as I share more of my power, you know, collectively we are stronger and I am stronger in the midst of that too. And that's what I would think is, I was going to say too about your question about how much is me, how much is feminine, how much, and that thing was, how much is my faith, you know, from your question. And I thought for me, it's all one, and I think that's another thing women bring, that integration of my faith, my personal, my feminine, and my history and everything else. And we resist having that pulled apart, like this, I'm my feminine person today and now I'm my faith person, but having that together at all times. And I think that maybe a feminine style of managing you would be one that gives you permission to be who you are in whatever integration that is. And I know I said once at the ordination, at the installation of another woman pastor, I said, one of my last bits of advice from my best experience was, enjoy being a woman serving God, enjoy being a woman pastor, and you'll be giving other people permission to enjoy being the person that God created them to be. And I think there's something in that facilitating, that empowering, that you give it and you have, you don't lose anything, you know, and you gain sisters and you gain brothers and you gain a sense of experiencing the mysteries of God rather than finding
more. For all of us, it boils down to having our identity based in Jesus Christ and knowing who we are as a person in Jesus. That's what it boils down to.
Mm-hmm.
Part of who I am as a person is a strong, authoritarian, efficient, wanting people to do their job and do it on time and do it well. And even as a teacher, wanting students to get their papers in on time, wanting to write good papers. And part of who I am as that kind of person and a woman is someone who generates a lot of resentment because I'm not always nurturing and having shoulder to cry on and, you know, all that stuff. And I don't like, because I'm a woman, I don't like the expectation on the part of many people that I have to give orders to or that I have to get work done with, that I be soft and gentle and nurturing and all that stuff. I mean, I've got a quota of that in me and I'll do that, but I won't, when I want to get work done with people, I just want to get work done with people. And my secretary having problems at home, you know, I sort of want her to wait until after work to cry because I want the work to get done, you know? I mean, I'm willing to do a certain amount of talking with people when I feel that I have time or that it's appropriate or that it's a crisis or that it's needed, but I also really think that I could be taken advantage of as a woman in a way that a man wouldn't be expected to behave. And I kind of bridle with that. Do you resonate with that, Omar?
Oh, I do. I mean, I think that there are times doing it the way I'm trying to do it makes it very hard to set the limits, and yet they really do have to be set.
Yes.
Because there are things to be done, I think it's still possible to do it.
Oh, I do too.
But it is true that, I mean, I was, at one point, I had a grant from the
National Institutes of Mental Health, and they wanted me to do a conference pulling together all the people in the country who were doing research on rape. Well, it turned out that a lot of the people who were doing these projects had a very non-hierarchical structure at each of their places. So they had in their own grant monies, they had money for trips, and no one was in charge of anything. And whoever hadn't had a trip got to be the next person to go to our conference, whether that was the secretary, the research assistant, the person who had conceptualized the project, the interviewers, whatever. And finally, NIMH took back the money because they said, we can't do it that way. We want all the people who are in charge to come. And yet a lot of these organizations refused to specify who was in charge. And I think that I really do think there was a time when a lot of feminist organizations felt that was the way to do things. One of my friends named Jenny Mansbridge wrote a book called Beyond Adversary Democracy. And what she was writing about was the difference between our having the one person, one vote, and being willing to give your vote for someone else to be in charge. And she was saying that when you have conflicting interests, you want everybody, one person, one vote, and then you let democracy work that way. But when you basically have interests in common, then it's better to let everybody give the power to a person in charge. And her example, which made it so clear to me what she was talking about, was the pilot of an airplane. It's perfectly all right with all of us that the pilot be in charge of flying the plane. We're not going to let the secretary or the research assistant or whatever, just because it's their turn, fly the plane. perfectly well. And I think that, you know, there's usefulness to that too.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of us, you know, wear different hats at different times, but sometimes you have to wear more than one hat at one time. And when these circumstances come up, sometimes they do have to be dealt with, even on company time. But sometimes you can say, no, that's to be later. I think this is, you know, in everyday life, as a mother, I'm a homemaker. I feel like I'm a real strong leader in my church and my community. And I'm totally against women pastors. But I still see, you know, that women have a strong place in the church. And I think different people at different times just have to say, okay, this is for me or this isn't for me. And you still have to get along with the community.
Well, it may be that maybe one of the important things for that issue is the willingness and the ability to be tolerant of other people, for each of us to figure out what it is that's important for us, and as long as we're not infringing on someone else.
Right, you still, you know, have to work together, and I know that, you know, that's a circumstance, but I'm sure if our church called a pastor who was a woman, I wouldn't be a member of that church, because that's a priority for me. But I can still appreciate and respect women working in the church as a pastor, even, and as long as it's another church.
You wouldn't have a woman pastor?
No.
Oh.
Why not? Because I don't feel it's scriptural. I know that's another whole subject and a hot one, but I don't feel it is scriptural. Hmm. I feel that women can be teachers and teach, but I just don't think that pastor and men preaching is for women. And I teach every day. I teach a class, and I teach women, I teach children, but I don't really teach men.
Why would you not teach men?
Because I don't think it's scriptural. I think that the men are to be the leaders and the teachers. And I mean, I don't...
But are there
male children in your classes?
Yes.
When do they get to be too old?
I suppose when they're through high school. I mean, I've taught teens a lot, but I just feel that that women have kind of taken over a lot of positions that belong to men, and I think that's why men do not take their rightful place, is because women have pushed them out of that place. They have.
What did you say?
Said maybe they've abdicated it too.
Yeah. And that's why lots of mothers stay the strong leaders, because the fathers haven't taken up what it's like. Anyhow, I know that's another whole subject.
But related, because it has to do with women's perceptions of other women. Can you really respect another woman in a leadership role? And if not, why not? You know, for me, there's something about scripture is one source of our inspiration and our identity. But God comes to us daily in so many ways, and every day I learn something new about who I am and what it means to be loved by God, and what it means to have God respect me. You know, it's not just me respecting God, but God actually respects me, and there are consequences when I discover that. And I think we all, you know, go through different stages of that. And you're right, it's not just it's not another subject, it's part of the same, but it's a broader one that involves mm-hmm. how do we interpret scripture and what part it has in our life, and but also underneath that is how we feel with other women and other men, you know, but what do we feel about our appropriate
well things? And to me there's another question, it's how people know what they're, when you're confronted with a lot of different options, how you know for sure which is the godlike or the prayerful or the faithful direction to take. I mean,
I find that, you know, there are a lot of talents and abilities that the Lord gifts various people with. And just because you're a woman doesn't mean, well, in the past, I think it meant that you weren't supposed to supposedly have leadership abilities and gain a following of sorts, or be teaching people things. But I mean, today, you know, women are accepted as corporation executives, but then again, they're not accepted as church leaders often. And but the gifts may be there. The gifting is by God, and what do you do if you're a gifted woman and you happen to have theological interest and interest in leading people to the Lord? Do you say, okay, well, that's not a realm where I can work, but I will go and work in a corporation and use my leadership abilities there?
Well, the other end, men too, who have gifts for the home. I know a number of men whose major responsibility is parenting the children. And I have a number of friends. Most of the men I know are much better cooks than I am. And I even like to cook. But, you know, allowing that to happen, saying, oh, you can't touch that because that's my domain. That's my rightful place. But, you know, just allowing gifts to pop up in surprising places. And, you know, once you've enjoyed the consequences of those gifts, it's easier to affirm them. But I would just suggest, too, you know, if anybody's willing to struggle with that whole issue of scripture and men and women and what does it really tell us about what we're supposed or not supposed to do, there are a couple of good books in the bookstore. One is by Virginia Rainey Mollenkopf called Men, Women, and the Bible. I was thumbing through that. I couldn't afford any more books, but I was thumbing through that. And she does, for instance, take Paul's sayings and say how he has different things. He doesn't say the same thing every place, but where he gets them from and why he says that. And those things are important to me to know, you know, if it's there, why is it there? You know, what does it say about the times, about him, about us as men and women today? And all those new things to learn about that as we struggle with those issues. And they're worth struggling with. They're exciting. They're fun. I think it's exciting.
You know, one thing I'd like to see, too, is that in my struggling with a lot of things, I'm not a pastor, but I have that theological training. And I don't expect to be a pastor in the future.
But I feel free to be one if the Lord should lead that way. And my basic orientation to Scripture is not a liberal orientation at all. I wouldn't say if you're thinking in terms of conservative versus
the traditional.
Yeah, the traditional conservative versus liberal. But the thing that I've felt all the way through is if you really are seeking God for yourself as an individual, God often leads you in pretty strange situations, and they're not always explainable to other people, and they're not always accepted by other people who do look at things in a more traditional view. There's a tendency for Christians to want to box God in with a certain modus operandi, a certain way of doing it. And I think, too, back to the managing thing, there's a tendency. See, I see all of these words up there, and I know the traditional view as to what's male and female, for example, masculine and feminine, but I basically don't agree that those are necessarily, statements for the way women must be or men must be. And I think, I basically think that there is a lot of variety within the universe and within creation, and that it's been a real sad thing that people have tried to just legislate the way people should respond in different situations and how a man should be and how a woman should be. And I think the church has made definitely too much of that. I think that talents show a much better way that, if God has given people talents, he would assume that he would want to use them. And so I think as a manager, too, if you are talented in certain ways and you have a particular orientation, there's nothing wrong with pursuing that unless it does not fit, as you said, with the organization. If it would not help facilitate the goals of the organization, then, why shouldn't you pursue it?
I think it's like a music professor once told me when I was thinking about going to seminary, getting a lot of flack from other music professors. He said, follow your heart. And I've always really thought that's the key to everything, is follow your heart. Because your heart, what your heart is speaking is what the Holy Spirit is putting into you.
Well, I think some people have a lot of trouble figuring out what their heart is telling them.
Oh,
it's especially hard when a lot of other people say, no, you can't do that. Yeah.
Your heart needs to tell you this.
Yeah. You know, makes it hard.
Well, that's what goes back to the Bible study. I think it was this week or last week, whenever it was, but saying in the early church, so much emphasis was given to the gifts of the Spirit. If somebody has the gift of the Spirit, you don't argue with the gifts of the Spirit. Regardless of what your mindset is, you say, well, I wouldn't have done it that way, but God chose that person, therefore we will respect this ministry. And we've gotten away from that in our culture, where we systematize everything and say, okay, these many people have these gifts, therefore these are the kind of people we want to do this work, rather than letting the Spirit sort of call forth out of the whole community people, most of them to us, very unlikely and unacceptable, but we struggle with that as a community. You know, God's ways are not our ways. Thank goodness.
Were any of you planning to go to the first setting of Watch?
No, I'm auditioning. I'm going to end of the first
okay.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Margaret.
Thank you. Good luck in your studies. Oh. You know what I was thinking of? I wanted to say, just your movie night.